ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Corbin Middlemass here from ABC Cricket Podcast. There has never been a more anticipated Ashes series than the one going down this summer. Australia versus England is always huge, but this feels generationally massive. A crucial clash needs a comprehensive analysis. So check out ABC Cricket Podcast. Join me and ex-Australia opener Ed Cowan every Monday and Friday, as well as after every day of play for the best conversation in cricket. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You are standing in a town, lined with cobblestone streets and nestled in a valley, with hiking trails stretching up into scenic pine forests. If you were to draw a line south from Frankfurt in Germany to Zurich in Switzerland, about halfway down that line is a village called Bad Wildbad. Today, it's a sort of luxury spa destination, famous for therapeutic waters and thermal baths. But back in 1793, something happened here that people still talk about. A mass poisoning.
People were dying, and this was happening in epidemic proportions.
But it wasn't a plague or contaminated water. It was something that the people of this town ate.
The one common thing that all of these people who died had experienced was eating blood sausage.
It took a long time to work out why this sausage was so deadly.
There was possibly an organic type of toxin that was coming from these sausages and killing the people, and that started the story.
I'm Mark Fennell, and this is the story of how the world's most deadly toxin went from killing German villagers to being tested as a biological weapon, and ultimately transforming the cosmetic industry under the name Botox. And no one saw it coming. Okay, so I have to know, if I had made a terrible life choice and actually eaten one of those German blood sausages, like what would have actually happened to me?
The nerve system starting in the head, the nerves going to your eyelids and the upper part of your face would start to get weak, and you'd have a droopy eyes, your face would fall, and it would move down into your throat, and your voice would go, and then it would go to the lungs. And it didn't get any farther because you died because you stopped breathing. So you made a good-looking corpse, and you died in 2 or 3 days. No wasting or anything like that, but you're dead. I'm Gene Helveston. My day job for 40-plus years was to be a pediatric ophthalmologist at Indiana University School of Medicine. Now I'm fully retired, and I'm in that category of the super old. I'm in my 90s, so... We won't talk about that anymore.
For people listening to the podcast, let's just be very clear. Gene does not look 90. You look very, very good, my friend. Very good.
Thank you.
Just between you and I, if I look as good as Gene does when I'm in my 90s, I will be a very happy man. But let's go back to the sausages. Now, it turns out that those sausages were so deadly because they'd only been lightly cooked. A little too lightly.
When they did the boiling of it, they didn't want to leave it on too long or have this potion get too hot, because the blood sausage, which was stuffed into intestines of a pig or whatever, would burst. So they went a little bit light on the cooking, making a good-looking dish, which was going to be fatal on the wrong circumstances.
So people are dropping like flies around not just this town, around Europe for eating dodgy meat. And everyone at this particular moment in time is kind of clueless as to why, until someone makes a breakthrough.
The first impact was realized by Junius Kerner, a poet, philosopher, and polymath in 1817, in also in southern Germany, near where the original outbreak occurred. It occurred to him that, yes, it was something in the blood sausage, but he tried to find out what part of the blood sausage maybe was really contributing to this.
Cut to Kerner's lab, where he starts experimenting on insects and small animals.
And he exposed them to various parts of the sausage contents, and it turned out that a fatty substance universally led to death of insects and led to muscle weakness in rabbits that he injected with this. And then in a really brave, heroic, maybe stupid gesture, he put a little bit of it on his tongue.
Yeah, I'm going to go with stupid, but that's just me.
And he felt a very astringent, tight feeling. He came to the conclusion that it somehow affected the autonomic nerves, the automatic nerves of the system, to do something. And what they did was to turn off secretion. So he was the one who number one, found the part of the blood sausage, the fat, that was carrying the toxin, but also what the toxin did, and it affected the neurological system. So that was a big deal.
It does take a few decades, but eventually we get a name for this substance. Botulinum toxin. And fun fact, the word botulism, it comes from the Latin word botulus, meaning sausage. But don't let the fun name fool you. This stuff was deadly.
Strong enough that if 3 or 4 heaping teaspoonfuls of it were perfectly pure and delivered in equal portions to everybody in the world, they'd be dead.
That's pretty deadly.
It's strong stuff. It doesn't take much of it to... There are other deadly toxins, but there's no toxin that so little of it can actually do you in.
Now, it's a funny thing that if you look back in the past, you'll see any deadly, wildly dangerous substance, eventually someone's going to try and weaponize it. And that is precisely what happened here. But who and when? Well, centuries after that German sausage, we are now in the middle of the 20th century. And you are in a top secret US military base called Camp Detrick.
Well, Camp Detrick was the Army Biological Warfare Center, and it was established to learn more about biological weapons because they were worried that the Axis might want to use them, although it turned out that Hitler had no intention of using biological weapons because he knew that we would react and probably do a better job. But young scientists were given the job of learning everything they could about several biological substances which could be weaponized. And one of them was botulinum toxin, and they did it, and for the first time, purified the toxin. Then another scientist figured out how it was blocking the nerve impulse from the nerve to the muscle.
After all of that, it never becomes a biological weapon in World War II, which is, you know, a good thing. But it also means that the toxin kind of languishes in terms of research. Now, here's the wild part. Thousands of miles away, the fate of that toxin was about to be rewritten by a charming eye doctor with the name Alan Scott.
Well, Alan Scott, well, he was my age, about a year and a half older than I was. He finished his training in 1961 in ophthalmology. He was just a nice guy, big, tall fellow, 6'2". He was quiet, he was unassuming, he was smart, but he didn't show off about it. He was possessed with the idea that there must be a better way to straighten eye muscles. So when we started our careers being eye surgeons with muscles, we weren't in a very high-level technique. So he wanted to do it better. So he thought, well, if he can find a substance to inject into the muscle that would weaken it, then he could get the job done. So he tried it with alcohol, he tried it with snake venom, he tried it with insecticides, and a whole bunch of different things. And all it did was wreck stuff or kill him, but didn't really do what he wanted to.
Okay, so now, remember that secret military camp where they were working on making the botulinum toxin into a biological weapon? Well, Alan got in contact with them, and they actually sent him some.
But he sent him a vial of toxin, enough to kill a whole herd of horses. So Alan said, well, we'll start off by diluting it. So he diluted it and diluted it and diluted it and diluted it. And he got it to the point where he could put it on laboratory animals and they all didn't die. And so Alan did that all himself, just sitting in his laboratory, like making a a recipe to bake cookies or brownies or something. He was doing that with this toxin.
And that, my friends, is why I'm never eating a brownie again. So what comes from this gradually more diluted version of one of the world's most deadly toxins? Well, monkeys happens. So in 1973, Allen used the toxin on the eye muscles of monkeys. And the result was intriguing. The muscles around the eye relaxed. And more importantly, the monkeys themselves, after this injection, were perfectly healthy. This is a huge light bulb moment. Next on the agenda, experiment on humans.
He had to guarantee that it was safe and so forth in this process. And he was all doing this on his own, just in his own little laboratory. And he injected the first human in 1978. And I said, wow, this is something. So I flew out to San Francisco to spend a couple of days with Alan. I said, what the heck are you doing? And he showed me. And he said, I'm opening a clinical trial. And do you want to be part of it? I said, sure.
So Gene flies back to Indiana with some of this drug to use in his own ophthalmology practice.
We used it for almost a decade, treating people with benign essential blepharospasm, with forceful closure of the lids and grimacing of the face and tongue and tilting of the head. And it worked and never had a single complication.
Gene, there is something amazing here, which is we have this toxin that for 150 years has only ever been associated with death and illness. You know, even that research into whether it could be used as a weapon in World War II, right? And then suddenly, Alan and you come along, and it takes a really profound mind shift to look at it and go, how can I use this to help people? And I think that is the crucial turning point here.
First of all, don't put me very high up in the order because I was just a...
You were there, Gene.
I was just a soldier. And the only reason we're here now is because there's only two of us left. Oh, one now who was around at the beginning. Well, what you just said was answered in 1570 by Paracelsus. And he said, what is a poison? Everything is a poison. It only depends on the dose. All the medicine that we use, you know, a lot of it, aspirin and you name it, it's useful as a medicine in the doses we give it. But if you crank it up a little bit, it'll kill you. And so botulism toxin was just a microcosm of what this is all about. And so he figured out that if we could get that weak enough, then minuscule amounts can do a very, very important task.
We should probably talk about the science of how all of this works. So if you were to inject it in near somebody's eye, like what are you actually doing? What is the toxin doing in that moment?
When the nerve gets a message from the brain or some higher center, the electric potential goes down the nerve and it gets to the place where it has to go across a synapse, like plugging in the light bulb. It has to get across that synapse and get to the nerve fiber that's going to make the muscle work. That connection is mediated or taken care of by a drug called acetylcholine. And what happens is the botulinum toxin deactivates the little cells at the end of the nerve fibers that produce acetylcholine to carry out this transfer of the electrical activity. It knocks them out of commission for 3 months. Before they can start to do it again. It's like walking around the Christmas tree and unplugging half of the lights, and then you have a very dull Christmas tree.
Was there a moment when you realized just how life-changing it could be for a person?
There was a big moment. We had a patient come in a wheelchair, pushed by her husband. She was in her 50s. She had a stroke in the brainstem. She had a palsy of the nerves on her face on the left-hand side. She was blind in the left eye. Her right eye was normal, except that it was moving right, left, up and down in torsions chaotically and never stopping. And everything in the world was moving around. She couldn't read and she couldn't do anything. So she came, she said, well, can you fix this with Botox? I said, well, okay, I'll try. And we injected 4 of the 6 muscles and it didn't do any good at all. And I said, well, I think I will try something, but you have to be a partner with me on this. I said, I can inject 25 units, which is about five times more than any dose I'd ordinarily give. But I'm going to inject it into your orbit behind your eye. And I said, I've never done this before, and nobody else has. And I said, you have to sign a consent form before we do it. I said, you may die when we do this. And I almost kind of mean it. There is a chance, because I don't know. And she said, well, you know, she said, my life is just not worth anything now. Let's do it. And we had an anesthesiologist standing by, and I had all the king's horses and all the king's men ready to stand by if something bad happened. So I injected it into her orbit, and nothing happened. And the next day, her eye was completely still, and she could see 20/30. I did it for about 5 years, a couple of times a year. And to me, that was a very important moment.
So how did this toxin go from this life-changing treatment to being used to smooth out wrinkles? Well, it turns out that Alan also had noticed that when he used it to treat people's eye conditions, somehow they just seemed to have fewer wrinkles next time. But I think the major turning point comes in 1982. So this is when a woman by the name of Dr. Jean Carruthers arrives in San Francisco to be Alan's academic fellow.
She observed Alan in his clinic and his laboratory, and she went back to her office in Vancouver, British Columbia. And her husband was a cosmetic dermatologist, and he worked on wrinkles and so forth.
So Jean Carruthers and her husband join forces. They start looking into treating wrinkles with that toxin, and their very first patient is their receptionist, Kathy. In 3 days, her forehead just smoothed, her eyebrows were elevated, and frankly, she just looked well and refreshed and younger. And of course, she loved it. Then Jean tried it herself, and I can happily report that she has not frowned since 1987.
And so she started using on her in her practice as part of the open trial, and it worked like a dream. So she started going around the country, or around the world, telling people about how you could get rid of worry lines and wrinkles and this and that easily with this. And at first it was an uphill battle, and she had a hard sell, but then she and her husband won prizes for innovation and so forth, and she got the drug approved for cosmetic use in 2000 in Canada, and then later it was in the U.S. So Jean Carruthers is personally responsible for the whole industry, and that accounts for about half of the Botox that's sold, and the other half goes for medical reasons.
Okay, so it's Dr. Carruthers who helped turn the toxin into this massive cosmetic injectable industry that we know today. What did you and Alan think about its anti-wrinkle properties at the time? Did you think that was a good idea?
I didn't care. I was not too happy when I heard about Botox parties and women would get together and do stuff like that. And I, some of the non-medical people who were using it purely as a cosmetic thing and like a beauty shop type of activity, you know, I wasn't too thrilled about, but that I didn't waste any energy worrying about that.
And Jean wasn't alone in that. Alan Scott was also uninterested in the toxin's ability to be a vanity drug.
And he said, I was okay in the clinic and did a pretty good job in the laboratory, but I was a lousy businessman. I said, any regrets, Alan? He said, nope, none, not one at all.
But if Alan Scott had been a better businessman, he would be a billionaire. I mean, in 1991, Alan sold the drug to a company for $9 million, which I grant you sounds like a lot, but really it was a bargain. That company then went on to change the drug's name to the one that we now know today, Botox.
When the drug sold, he sold it for just about enough money to have him go back and break even, because he mortgaged his house and he scrounged around to get the money to the approximately $4 million it took to as cash outlays to get the research done, to do a job that pharmaceutical companies would spend $500 million to $1 billion to do. So he did something that was just unheard of never before done and never since done. So he was a groundbreaker, and it was just nice to know about a guy and work with the guy who had absolutely no interest in fame or fortune.
Today, Botox is the most common cosmetic procedure performed around the world. There are some estimates that say nearly 3 million injections happen each year. And I think it's worth pointing out that it's not just about smoothing out wrinkles or stabilizing eye spasms. It's also used to treat a range of things. Excessive sweating, drooling, migraines. And all of that, it does go back to Alan Scott and his willingness to try something new. And I guess kind of daring.
Alan demonstrated something that I think was common in young doctors coming into practice in the years not too long after World War II, when there was a lot of realignment and a lot of things going on. And there was a very hopeful and encouraging attitude. And Alan was the poster boy sort of that kind of happy and confident way of doing things, and he was just a good example of about everything that was good about medicine in that particular time.
And so when you tell the story of Botox, what do you think is the most important part of its legacy that you want people to remember?
The Botox story tells of a chain of scientists who, using their own wits, were able to go from that toxin to a drug that's useful to help mankind, that all this took place with individual efforts and no big governments, no subsidies, no anything, no sponsorship, just people interested in doing a good job. That's what makes it fun and exciting. And that, like, every one of these people who we mentioned is a hero to me. Alan just was at the tail end of it, and he put it all together, and it worked out. And he's a hero to me. And I was just sort of lucky to be able to be around when this was all going on, and I get to be the surviving person who can tell the story.
I do have to ask before I let you go, Gene, and you knew this question was coming. Have you ever tried Botox yourself?
No.
Really? You've never been tempted?
No. No. No, never been tempted. You know, when really hard sell to young doctors, and they give us medicines and try this and try that and so forth. I never tried any of it. So I would not be a very good customer for a drugstore. I have a very great admiration for good medicine, but only take it if you need it.
You know the saying about doctors make the worst patients.
Yeah, I was probably one of them.
Dr. Eugene Helverson is a former ophthalmologist and the author of the book Death to Beauty, the transformative history of Botox. Now, I would like to give a very special shout out here. Kerr, Sandy and Kate, what do they have in common? They are all people who wrote in over the last couple of weeks suggesting the story of Botox, the history of Botox for the show, and I hope you liked the episode. How good was Dr. Eugene? I'd also like to say a big thanks to all of you. We found out a little while ago that No One Saw It Coming has been named as one of Apple Podcasts' best shows of 2025. I think we're the number two new Australian show on the chart. I don't really know how their charts works, but I'm grateful, and I'm mostly grateful to you. If you listened, if you reviewed, if you told your friends, thank you. Please continue to do so. If you're a new listener to the show who's just finding us because of that, hey, welcome. Please go back and enjoy the other episodes. Apparently, it's not bad. And of course, as always, if you have an idea for us to investigate, all you need to do is email us noonesawitcoming@abc.net.au. If you are keen to hear another medical story, can I recommend? There's a really wonderful episode about this woman called Henrietta Lacks, who had her cells from her body stolen.
And consent is the issue that has colored this case from its beginning to today. At the time she went into the hospital, she signed a form, which we have a copy of consent to surgery. And that the form essentially said the surgeons can do whatever they want to help the treatment of the disease or the condition that I had. But it wasn't a consent to use any part of her body for research. Consent did not exist in the 1950s. So consent wasn't an issue in medicine. Should it have been? Absolutely, and of course. But two cultures were taken from Henrietta Lacks, one from her normal tissue and one from the cancerous tissue.
The story of Henrietta Lacks and her stolen cells, you can find it in the podcast feed. Just kind of scroll back to, I guess, kind of mid-October. My name is Mark Fennell. The producer was Zoe Ferguson. The sound engineer was Angie Grant. We are coming to you on Gadigal Land in Sydney, Australia for ABC Radio National. I'll be back with a brand new episode of No One Saw It Coming next week. Until then, goodbye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.